Judges chapter 9, entitled today's message, The Bramble King. That's taken from the parable here in Judges chapter 9. To understand Judges chapter 9 properly, we have to back up a little bit to chapter 8, to the conclusion of the life of Gideon. So look back, chapter 8, verses 22 and 23. It says, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Now Gideon here clearly articulates the truth that the Lord was to rule over them. We're going to find, however, in this chapter, the people rejecting that truth that the Lord was to rule over them. Now, indeed, one of the sons of Gideon decides he's going to rule over them. And we're going to see when the people reject the Lord's rulership, they make the foolish choice of a bramble king, a ruthless, ambitious, self-centered individual that they choose to rule over them. And this, the spiritual truth for us here is when our hearts become hardened and unsubmissive to the Lord's rule over us, the result will be that we make equally foolish and self-destructive decisions. When we refuse the Lord's authority, His rulership, when we begin to say no to the Holy Spirit's promptings and movings in our heart, then we, like the people of Israel, will begin to make foolish choices, self-destructive choices. Indeed, we're going to see this is the case as the people choose this bramble king, Abimelech, to be their king. We've not read, it was a lengthy chapter today, so I didn't have Norman read all 57 verses, but we're going to try to look at all of them briefly. But in this chapter, we're going to see three stages of Abimelech, this bramble king, three stages of his kingship. Verses 1 to 21, we're going to see his seizing of the kingdom. Verses 22 to 49, which we did read, we're going to see him defending the kingship that he has seized. And then in verses 50 to 57, we'll see him losing his kingdom. But let's look, first of all, at his seizing the kingdom. First thing I want to call your attention to about Abimelech is his character. We find here an individual who is very ambitious, very determined, and really so self-centered, he's focused only upon himself and his own interests. You know, Gideon's spiritual decline had been due to what I might call latent self-interest. As Gideon sort of exploited the God-given victory over the Midianites, he exploited that victory, first of all, to settle a personal vendetta that he had with Zeba and Zalmunna, the two kings of Midian, who had killed his brothers. And so he utilizes that victory to get personal vengeance against them. The victory over Midian had also won him the admiration of his fellow Israelites. And while he refused their offer to be made king, he utilized their gratitude and attention to enrich himself. He became a very wealthy man from the golden earrings he requested from the people, taking advantage of their gratitude, as well as taking the spoils from these two kings. And he lived out the rest of, it says Israel had rest for 40 years, the rest of the days of Gideon, and he lived out the rest of his life living, in essence, like a king. So there was this sort of latent self-interest in Gideon. But in the son whom he named Abimelech, and we saw last week that Abimelech's name means "my father is king." Abi is my father, Melech is king. My father is king. We find that the latent self-interest that was in Gideon, we see full-blown, aggressive ambition and self-interest in the son whom he named Abimelech. Abimelech was a son of Gideon, Israel's hero. And as such, the expectation when they came in chapter 8, verse 22, and said, "You know, Gideon, you reign over us, your son, your grandson," they were offering him, in essence, a monarchy, a dynasty. So there was this expectation of the people that one of the sons of Gideon deserved to reign. This son of Gideon, however, was, it says he was the son of Abimelech's concubine. So his mother was part of Gideon's harem, but he did not marry her and make her a wife. We're going to find out perhaps later why. The son of a concubine was in a very divided situation. Legally, he had no rights from his father. Since his mother was not married to Gideon, there was no right of inheritance through his father. We see here in this chapter, really, his closeness, his belongingness was really on his mother's side. So Abimelech had his father's genes, but not his father's name. You'll note later in the chapter, verse 18, as Jotham is speaking, he calls him the son of Gideon's female servant, sort of a put down in comparison to the other 70 sons of his legitimate wives. So Abimelech was an outsider. You can imagine the bitterness that he felt towards his father and toward his half-brothers. And that bitterness perhaps drove him to, in desperation, to right the wrongs he felt he endured in his childhood, to get revenge. And we're going to see, certainly there's animosity here between his mother's side of the family and his father's side of the family. He was an individual man who felt that whatever he's going to get out of life, he'll have to get for himself. And he goes after it with a determination and a ruthlessness. He was fully determined to get whatever he could. So that's the character of the individual we're looking at here. An individual who, in his determined self-interest, we're going to find in this chapter, he kills literally thousands of people. So a very ruthless individual. I want you to notice not only his character, but his campaign. He was driven by pride and selfish ambition. As such, he sets about to establish himself as king, despite the fact that his father Gideon had said, "I'm not going to rule over you, nor will my son or my grandson rule over you. The Lord is to rule over you." Well, now, however, one of these sons sets out that he's going to rule over them. What does he do? We see, first of all, he exploits the racial aspect of the contention that's present here in this chapter between the descendants of Gideon and the people of Shechem. Remember back when we introduced the book of Judges, one of the things that was true of Israel at this point was that when they went into the promised land, they failed to drive out all the Canaanites. Remember back, and if you turn back to chapter 1, in verse 21, as well as in verse 27 to 33, it names the various tribes, and it says they did not drive out the inhabitants. So we have Canaanites living amongst the children of Israel here. And it appears that Abimelech's mother's brothers that are referred to here in chapter 9, it appears that they're a part of a Canaanite contingency of people dwelling in the city of Shechem. These people were Baal worshippers, as we find out. a hint later in the chapter, if you look at verse 28, that there's this contention between Israelites and Canaanites. We're going to find this later usurper, Gaal. He says in verse 28, he says, "Who is Abimelech? Who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal, and is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem." Now, who was Hamor and who was Shechem? If you go all the way back to Genesis, and you remember Jacob and his 12 sons before going into Egypt, and they're living in Canaan here. Shechem, the son of Hamor, was the individual who slept with Dinah, Jacob's daughter, which infuriated Dinah's brothers. Shechem wanted to marry her, and the family, the brothers, said to Hamor and to Shechem, "Look, we can't let you marry her unless you become circumcised like we are. That's the only condition that you could marry her." So they agree, okay, we'll do that. And then it says two of Jacob's sons, I think it was Simeon and Levi, while the men of Shechem were still in pain and sore from the circumcision, it says they come and they slaughter them, they kill them. So there's some long-standing animosity between Canaanites and Israelites here. But that's who Shechem and Hamor were, and he's referring back to the long-standing Canaanite population of this city. Perhaps this is the reason why Gideon never married Abimelech's mother. There might have been some stigma that he was marrying a Canaanite. Perhaps all his other wives were Israelites, but Abimelech's mother probably, and I say probably, we don't know for sure, but probably she was a Canaanite. We find that Abimelech exploits the animosity that obviously existed toward Gideon's descendants. And he leads them to believe, "Look, I'm one of you. You elect me king, I'll look after your interests. I'm one of you." He says, "I'm your flesh and your bone." And it says they were inclined to make him king because he said, "He's our brother." So you have a case here where one selfishly ambitious person in his self-interest is appealing to the self-interest and selfish ambition of other people to form this alliance. Now, you've got an alliance between two parties, both of which are only looking after themselves, really. Not a very stable alliance, to put it lightly. It's also noteworthy in this chapter that all this going on, Gideon is never referred to by his name Gideon. He's called Jerubbaal right through the whole chapter. You remember back in chapter 6, that was the derogatory name that was given to him when he tore down his father's Baal altar. And as a derision, called him Jerubbaal, the one that contends with Baal. Let Baal contend with him. And they gave him that name. And here, they're using that derogatory name right through the chapter, but it's the same Gideon by his Jewish, his Israelite name. And he's appealing to that. You'll note verse 2 and verse 3. He says, "Remember, I am your own flesh and bone." Verse 3, their hearts were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is our brother." So he's appealing this person of self-interest is appealing to the men of Shechem, to their self-interest. And he's finding that the same thing that is motivating and driving him is very useful in motivating and driving them as well. So he exploits the racial aspect here. He also exploits the religious aspect of the contention. From verse 4 and verse 46, we discover that Abimelech's mother's brothers and the people of Shechem were Baal worshippers. It's interesting that Abimelech's initial campaign here is financed with offerings that were made to Baal. They take monies from the temple of Baal, and he says he hires worthless and reckless men to follow him and carry out his murderous plot of seizing the kingship. I say murderous. Now imagine in your mind, it says he goes to his father, Gideon's hometown, and the plan is to kill all 70 of Gideon's sons. Now, they only get 69. The youngest manages to escape the execution. But imagine in your mind the execution, and one day it says on one stone of 69 men. That's how ruthless an individual, a person so intent on his own self-interest, his own ambition. And think of how cheap life is, as this story illustrates. It says they give him 70 shekels, one for each life that he would kill. Pretty cheaply hired murderers. So he's exploiting, and I say exploiting because it's interesting as you follow the story through the chapter, and Jotham's curse comes to fruition. These same people that he said, remember, you're my flesh, you're my bone, I'm your brother. They flee into the stronghold of Baal, and he burns down the stronghold of Baal with 1,000 of them in it. People he had previously said, you're my brother. He was neither a loyal Baal worshiper nor a true brother. He was only looking out for himself. For himself. Next we see the Bramble King's curse. You'll notice in the very last verse of the chapter, the very last phrase, it says, on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, on Abimelech as well as the people of Shechem. Jotham was the youngest son of Gideon who escapes the execution by Abimelech and his hired henchmen. And it says here that as they're making Abimelech king there at Shechem, now the geography plays into this here. Shechem was in a valley between two mountains, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And while in the valley below in the city, the coronation is going on, making Abimelech king, Jotham climbs Mount Gerizim, which would be overlooking the city. And scholars think perhaps he climbed out onto a rock outcropping that would overlook the city, where the acoustics that he could shout and be heard by the people, and he's sort of interrupting the coronation ceremony with this parable that he tells. A bit of Bible trivia for you. This is the very first parable in the Bible. So if you ever ask that question, what's the first parable in the Bible? Remember, Jesus utilizes parables teaching. This is the very first parable. And a parable is merely a story using physical objects to portray a spiritual truth. So the parable here, Jotham pictures the trees looking for a king. So they approach the olive tree with its valuable oil. They approach the fig tree with its sweet fruit. They approach the vine with its clusters that could be made into wine. But all of them refused to accept the honor. Here there were trees that were useful, productive, valuable trees. And they approach and say, you hold sway over us. You be king. You reign over the trees. They were all useful and productive trees that simply wanted to function as God intended them to function. They show a confidence in their own worth, and they had no need to pursue a position to give themselves worth. And they decline. Finally, in their search for a king, they come to the bramble bush, a totally useless bush. It bore no fruit. You notice here the bramble king says, come and take relief in my shade. Well, bramble bushes were hardly very high. They didn't provide really any shade, so to speak of. And on top of that, it was a dangerous bush because in the heat of summer, it could easily catch a fire and catch blaze and set the countryside afire. The point here is, what he's illustrating by this parable is that the people's foolish desire for a king, which was contrary to God's will, you know, Gideon had clearly stated that the Lord is to rule over you. It was contrary to God's will. It leads the people to accept something, a person, that totally lacked any value. By crowning Abimelech, they were choosing to submit themselves to an absolutely worthless man. He couldn't give them the protection they wanted. And besides that, he was dangerous and he would destroy them. They eventually would get exactly what they deserved. Jotham presses home the application of his parable. He challenged the people of Shechem with their treatment of Gideon, his father, and his family. He says there, verse 16 and 17, "Now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt with Jerubbaal and his house, and have done to him as he deserves, for my father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian." He's asking the question, but he's in essence saying, "You haven't dealt faithfully with my father and my house." You can imagine, 69 of his brothers killed. His family essentially wiped out. He said, "You haven't dealt faithfully with my family." He also, verse 19 mentions this, and it was even prophesied in the previous chapter. If you look back at chapter 8, verse 35. Verse 34 says, "They didn't remember the Lord," verse 35, "nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, Gideon, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel." So he says, I want you to think, are you dealing faithfully with my father who risked his life, who was God's instrument to deliver you from Midian? And then he uses a curse formula, verse 20, to call down divine judgment. A judgment that meant that both parties, Abimelech and the men of Shechem, both parties in this devilish arrangement would eventually destroy one another. He's saying, you deserve one another. And the curse here is, they're eventually going to destroy one another. And we have here a problem, not just one of bad leadership in Abimelech, but also one of evil followership in the people of Shechem. Again, a lesson for us. When we turn from God's purposes to our own devices, our choices will only be foolish and self-destructive. And certainly we're going to see that was what was true here with Abimelech and the people of Shechem. We didn't read verses 22 to 49, but here we find Abimelech having to defend the kingdom that he has so ruthlessly seized. You know, it's one thing to acquire a throne. It's quite something else to defend and retain it. Again, there's a lesson for us here. You know, sometimes we think in our self ambition and self-interest and self-centeredness, if I could only get what I want. Sometimes when you get what you want, you find that trying to manage what you got is more than you realize. It becomes more problematic than you realize. And we see here that all the schemes of a proud and ambitious Abimelech, as well as all the alliances formed between he and his cohorts, could not overcome the power of a sovereign God who was working behind the scenes to bring about justice for the evils that have been committed. Made me think of Proverbs 16:5, where it says, "Everyone proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Though they join forces, none will go unpunished." These verses, we find that indeed, behind the scenes, God was at work carrying out his judgment against both Abimelech and the people of Shechem. It tells us here in verse 23, it says, God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. Literally, God created an attitude of conflict between the men of Shechem and Abimelech. And later, verse 23, it says, the men of Shechem dealt treacherously. In other words, they weren't loyal to this new king that they had appointed as their king. What did they do? It says they set men in ambush, verse 25. They set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who passed by them along the way. In their treachery, these bandits were robbing Abimelech of both money and reputation. The merchants would hear about these bandits and would take an alternative trade route, avoiding not only making a more safer route, but then Abimelech would not collect the tariffs that usually he would collect from these merchants. But even more so, his reputation as a king would be hurt when the word would get out that the roads through that area which Abimelech controls are not safe for business, and would harm his reputation as a king. One of the commentators made this observation. He says, all too often, I've seen Christians turn away from the lordship of Jesus Christ and embrace a false promise of freedom. For a while, it seems to be very good. There is the enjoyment of the pleasure of sin for a short time. After all, Abimelech reigned for 3 years before his rule turned to ashes in their mouths. Then, in despair, they recognized their mistake and tried to deal with it. All too often, in the midst of this kind of disillusionment, Christians do exactly what these Shechemites did. What they should have done was turn to God in radical repentance and submit to Him as King. Instead, they tried to deal with Abimelech on their own, still leaving God out, and the result was self-destruction. So how did they deal with it? Well, along comes, and they're discontent with Abimelech, and they're not being loyal to him. Along comes, as it were, another worthless bramble. This one's name is Gaal, the son of Ebed. It says Gaal and his brothers come to town. They were sort of a proud, braggadocious lot. And they were even more worthless than Abimelech and his worthless and reckless men. And verse 26 says, the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. You read the chapter, you find out it's harvest time. They've gathered in the harvest. And the wine is flowing freely, and in their drunkenness, he curses Abimelech. Says, if I was king, I would rid you of this Abimelech. And he's a very proud, bragging, self-confident individual. And so a new alliance is formed. The men of Shechem form an alliance with Gaal. Once again, here's another alliance formed between proud and ambitious people. And any time alliances are formed by people with unstable character, the alliance is equally unstable. All that they're doing here is they're merely exchanging their loyalty from one worthless ruler for another worthless ruler. That's all that's happening here. We see in the story, too, another character that's involved here, and that's Zebul. Zebul was Abimelech's appointed ruler over the city of Shechem. And Zebul here is a bit of the traitor amongst them. He plays the part like he's right along with all the rest of the people, and he's okay with this. But then it comes out, he secretly sends word to Abimelech. That's why I say he's the secretive traitor. Gaal and his brothers have come to town. He's going to make a push here to make himself king over the city. But he sends secretively word to Abimelech. Abimelech, here's what's happening. Here's what I suggest. Here's how you can squash this rebellion by Gaal and the followers he's he's gaining here in the city. I think he's equally a self-interested individual. You know, we see that right through this whole chapter of all these people. Perhaps he's loyal to Abimelech simply because he wants to maintain his position as ruler of the city. As long as Abimelech's in power, he's been appointed by Abimelech. He's looking after the position he holds. We find that his own personal self-interest was misplaced. His loyalty to Abimelech was misplaced, because we're going to find out later, verse 45, Abimelech, it says, demolished the city and sowed it with salt. If he was wanting to preserve his rulership over the city, the guy he's loyal to eventually destroys the city, spreads salt so that the land is worthless. So there's a bit of misplaced loyalty there. I think Zebul's thought was, I'll inform Abimelech, he'll get rid of Gaal and his brothers, and we can go back to the way it was. But what eventually resulted was the total destruction of the city. You see his treachery as he first conceals it, his secretive letting Abimelech know, and then when later Gaal, verse 38, he sort of taunts him, this braggadocious Gaal. He says, "Where indeed is your mouth now with which you said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him? And are not these the people whom you despise? Go out, if you will, and fight with them now.'" He's sort of like, I heard you. Now it's time to put up or shut up. You said you would take out Abimelech. Have at it now. Go do it. Which we find that as Gaal goes out, Abimelech has followed the suggestion by Zebul. He comes and he defeats Gaal and his followers that he had gained in the city of Shechem. But again, Abimelech, I think, is a ruler who, though very ambitious, is very insecure. It's not just enough to drive out Gaal. He wants to punish the disloyalty of the people of the city, and he kills the people of the city. It says the people, the next day, thinking, okay, the conflict with Gaal and his brothers is over, and it says they go back out into the fields to work. But Abimelech shows up again the next day, this time with three parties. He puts one, positions one at the gate of the city so that the workers can't flee for safety back into the city. So they're blocking the entrance to the city. Meanwhile, the other two troops slaughter all the workers in the field. Again, you're getting an idea of how ruthless an individual this is. So he kills all the workers. Those that do manage to escape, it says they flee into the stronghold of the Baal temple. I looked up this word stronghold. The idea, at first, I used to always think it was a tower, like the next city he attacks. But the word indicates it was like an underground cellar. Because you'll notice later in verse 49, it says Abimelech and his men pile the branches they've cut down. It says they pile them against the stronghold and set the stronghold on fire above them, thus killing about 1,000 men and women. So here's the picture. They fled into this underground safe, what they think is a safe cellar. Abimelech and his men come with the branches of trees they've cut down, pile it against the entrance, set it on fire, and either by death by smoke or burned alive, 1,000 men and women. And these were the people early in the chapter, "You're my flesh and bone. You're my brothers." He burns them alive. Then we come to verses 50 to 57, the losing of the kingdom. Here we have the mention of the city Thebes. Thebes was evidently a nearby city that was confederate with Shechem in their opposition to Abimelech's rule. Again, the ruthless Abimelech, I think due perhaps to his insecurity, he can't rest until he has wiped out every pocket of resistance and disloyalty. He's going to be done with every person that opposes him, is disloyal to him. He's burned 1,000 of his own flesh and blood brothers who weren't faithful. And so he proceeds there with the intent of rendering to Thebes a similar fate that he had rendered to Shechem. As he takes the city, the idea is sort of after you've penetrated the outer walls, the people flee to this tower in the city for safety. And Abimelech approaches the tower, I think, with similar strategy that he had utilized at Shechem, thinking, I'll burn down this tower and the people in it. But in God's providence, it says a woman drops a millstone on Abimelech's head. Now, a millstone, when they would grind their flour in those days, depending on whether you had a household or a commercial one, they could be anywhere from sort of that size and maybe that thick, each stone, to the ones that were turned by a donkey might be a meter and a half across, and it's probably the household one here because the woman wouldn't pick up the larger one. But you can imagine if you had a stone that big in circumference, that thick, and you heave it over the wall, and the force it will have as it falls from that tower and it strikes him right on the head. It says he crushes his skull. You know, Abimelech, this king, this Bramble king, he had with force acquired his kingship, first of all by killing 69 sons of Gideon. He had slaughtered hundreds, if not thousands, of people in his ruthless attempt to retain that kingship as others threatened his rule and were disloyal to him. And now we see his end. How humbling for such a proud man who had ruled with such strength and brutality to, in the end, be killed. Not by some heroic warrior, but by a woman. But by a woman. And with his last words, he fights to retain his pride by ordering his armor bearer to kill him, saying, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, a woman killed him." You know, Abimelech had hoped that his pride would be preserved and no one would remember his humiliating death. But turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11. The story here is of David's unfaithfulness with Bathsheba, and he gives instructions to Joab, put her husband in the forefront of the battle, withdraw from him that he can be killed. And Joab is sending word back to David, I followed your instructions, Uriah is killed. And look at verse 18, Joab is perhaps anticipating some argument or response from David. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messenger, saying, "When you have finished telling the matters of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, 'Why did you approach so near to the city when you fought? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall?' Who struck Abimelech, the son of Jerubbesheth? Was it not a woman who cast a piece of millstone him from the wall so that he died in Thebes?" Despite Abimelech's trying to preserve his pride, his name went down in the records of Jewish wars for kings and generals to read. He was killed by a woman. He was killed by a woman. So Judges chapter 9 records for us the events that followed in the aftermath of the life of Israel's great deliverer, Gideon. Though Gideon had expressed what was right in his statement in Judges 8:23, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." Yet we find that he failed to call his sons and Israel to practice the truth that he had spoken. Instead, he lived out the rest of his days living the life of a king. You know, you can live in peace if you just tell people what's right, but you don't call them to do it. And that's essentially what Gideon did. He said, "This is what's right," but he didn't compel neither his own son nor the people of Israel to make the Lord their king. And as a result, one of his sons, Abimelech, whose name means "my father is king," after his death, sets about to establish himself as Israel's king. And through treachery, ruthless murder, and wicked alliances, he was able to rule for a brief 3 years. 3 years of an insecure reign for him as he constantly was having to squash challenges to his rule, as well as 3 years in which many over whom he ruled were savagely murdered by his ruthless power. You know, up to this point in the book of Judges, Israel had been oppressed by foreigners from without. But now, the oppression is coming right from within its own ranks, its own people, its own king. The Bramble King Abimelech's life ends when the proud, ruthless murderer king is killed himself by a woman. And his dying words are a final attempt to preserve the memory of his proud, ambitious career. But to no avail, the proud ruler would always be remembered as having been slain by a woman. Again, the lesson for us is that when we refuse to allow the Lord to rule over our lives, then the ruthless Abimelech of our own sinful nature will take over and rule our lives. The book of Romans puts it this way, that either we will be a slave of sin leading to death, or of obedience leading to righteousness. You know, the devil wants us to believe that you're free and you're the one controlling your own destiny. Abimelech thought he was in control of his destiny, and that by his own might and power he could make himself king. What he forgot was that God had not abdicated his throne, and he was silently working in the hearts and circumstances of people to bring about his will and justice in the life of Israel. The poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, in his poem Retribution, put it this way, "Though the mills of God grind slowly, yet they grind exceeding small. Though with patience he stands waiting, with exactness grinds he all." And Judges chapter 9 ends with a reminder that God is still on his throne, and that, as Daniel says, "The Most High rules in the kingdom of men, giving it to whomever he will." It says, "Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers, and all the evil of the men of Shechem, God returned on their own heads. And on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal." And may God spare us from rejecting his rule and choosing a bramble king to rule over our lives. Let's bow in prayer as we close.